Hello and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep minute by minute in the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I'm Zach.
We're back again with another episode. This episode starts and ends with surprise entrances.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Who'd have thought? So yesterday we ended off with kind of beginning to talk about Muad'Dib.
A little bit.
A little desert mouse.
Bouncing around the dunes there.
Yep. I kind of teased some of the subject of today's episode. So We're starting this minute kind of in a weird shot because it's on a super close-up of Muad'Dib's giant ears. And we see, you know, condensed water on the ears itself. And we kind of begin to see how Muad'Dib is able to hydrate itself in the desert.
Yeah.
This is not science fiction.
Yeah.
Kind of. So, I talked about how there's a couple different kinds of kangaroo mice that exist in the world. They have normal-ish size mouse ears. They're a little larger, but not the giant rabbit-ass looking ears that we see here for Muad'Dib. But there is a desert beetle in Africa.
Okay.
That it's the Namib darkling beetle. And I actually knew about this before doing research for this episode because I saw it on some version of like Planet Earth.
Sure.
Or some show like that, where basically what these beetles do is that they will climb up dunes of the desert first thing in the morning. And they'll just stick their ass in the air. Because what happens is as the sun is rising over the desert, it's pushing all of the cooler, what is now foggier air out towards the sea.
Yeah.
And because there's water in the air, what's happening is that when the beetle puts its abdomen into the air, there are hydrophilic, almost like barbs on the body that are super small, but they're enough to, there's enough surface tension there to gather water. And as the water droplets grow larger, gravity does its thing because they're kind of
angled down,
face downward into the sand,
face down, ass up.
Yes.
That's the way they like to collect water.
Yes. Yes. I was doing my best to avoid face down ass up, but you know, face down ass up, they're collecting water. There are in the thorax hydrophobic essentially channels.
Okay.
Which forces the water forward towards the mouth. And that's how these beetles drink.
All right.
So as far as the physics for Muad'Dib, it's not
unlike that.
Unlike it.
Yeah.
It would be a little different, obviously, because it's their giant ear flaps and everything. But you got to consider, too, that ear skin, like if whenever you pet like a cat's ear or a dog's ear, it's never warm. It's always like colder.
Yeah.
So that's where you're going to get that condensation and everything. You see Muad'Dib take its kind of front arms and kind of like drag the water from the ears into its mouth and everything.
Yep.
Pretty cool.
Gives itself a little bath.
Yeah.
Drinking the water.
Our own desert mice, though, do have their own ways of extending their water supply, because I obviously was looking up some of this as well. They have some really interesting things that they do where they, you know, lower their body temperature. They reduce the amount of food that they eat, like to the point where they eat barely anything.
Okay.
Because they don't have to then put as much water into their digestive tract and stuff like that. You can very quickly go down how animals have evolved to survive in deserts.
Sure.
It's a huge rabbit hole.
Mouse hole in this instance.
Indeed. but yeah, no, it's just, it just reminds me of something that Stilgar says when he says Muad'Dib makes his own water.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. It's very quite literal.
Yeah. I just think it's cool.
There's a reason that so much of the Fremen technology has been kind of adapted from this mouse's.
Yeah.
You know, and specifically the mouse. Like you think about the the, oh gosh, I forget what they call them. Like their air filtration system that they pull water out of the air.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say airfoil, but that's not right.
No, it's in, not sponsored, Art and Soul of Dune, yeah. Volume 2, okay. Which we'll talk about that when we get into Dune Part 2. But yeah, no, there's that, and then there's...
Wind traps. The wind traps,
yes, I believe. That's what they call them. But then also how like the wind traps take inspiration from things that humans were doing in Iran thousands of years ago with their own like AC systems and stuff. It's so fucking cool. I don't want to get off on a tangent about
that's fine.
That just yet because it's not entirely relevant. But
sure.
Point is that the way that Muad'Dib creates water is not unknown to nature as we see it now, which is one of the things that I like about, you know, just having a grounded sense of reality with some of the decisions that are made here.
All good sci-fi is based in truth.
Yep.
It can stretch and bend and twist that truth, but it is based in reality.
While we are talking about the Art and Soul of Dune, in Volume 1, they do show a actual physical prop of Muad'Dib that was made to be used as a reference material for this digital mouse that we see on screen. Last week, we talked about shitty CGI. This is not that.
This is very good CGI.
Yeah. The CGI that was done for Muad'Dib was great.
Yep.
And after a few seconds of it, you know, gathering its water and, you know, just kind of sitting on the peace and calmness of the sand, we get like a low rumbling and Muad'Dib begins to jump away and we hear its little squeaks and oh my god, fucking squeaks are so goddamn cute. I wanted to punch my monitor.
Ooh, cuteness aggression there, bud.
Oh yeah. But Muad'Dib doesn't fully run away. It just kind of
gets out of the
pops
way.
Up to the top of the dune and it stays there and it's silhouetted in the sun. Mm-hmm. We see the sand begin to kind of erupt from from the side of the dune. And who appears from the not so subtle birth canal coming out of the Frem tent womb?
Yeah.
But good old Paul Atreides.
Yeah. A lot more of that, that you know, birthing image.
Symbolism.
Imagery and symbolism of this.
Yeah. And Paul just kind of is looking around and what does he see but Muad'Dib? And they kind of have a moment where they're just staring at each other.
Yeah. In my notes here, in all caps, I put, could this mean something?
No, not at all. Muad'Dib just kind of looks around for a second and then just bounces and disappears. And Paul's just kind of left there almost.
He looks impressed.
The look on his face. He's wondering for a second. He's contemplating for a moment.
Well, yes, absolutely. He is. I took that, you know, I saw a look of, you know, impression or impressedness.
Impressedness?
Yeah.
Okay.
He seemed to be impressed by the mouse, is what I wrote in my notes. So, yeah, their little moment's gone, and he helps Jessica get out of the sand.
Yep. As he's helping Jessica out, an ornithopter suddenly buzzes over them.
Mm-hmm. Specifically a Harkonnen ornithopter.
It is a Harkonnen ornithopter, but... we see a very familiar flight pattern to one that we saw earlier.
Yep.
And we see something that only a very skilled pilot could do with a quick, you know, hairpin turn and then a settling down on the ground. And Paul knows it's Duncan.
Yeah. Yeah. He goes as far as to say it.
That's Duncan.
Yeah.
Thank you, Captain Obvious, once again. But yeah, no, Paul can tell because of the piloting skills that Duncan has.
I'm going to hop forward in the normal cadence of the show and read my book note here.
Okay.
Well,
I was going to say is the last 10 seconds of the minute are Paul and Jessica walking through a windy desert towards the ornithopter and Duncan meets them and embraces them.
Yep.
He's visibly distraught and rightfully so.
Sure. Sure. The moment from this chapter that I pulled out, for the book notes, it's actually at the very beginning of the chapter with Jessica and Paul.
And a reminder that we are now in part two of the book.
No, so this is still part one. So this is still the last chapter of the part one of the book.
Got it.
But this is coming at the very beginning of this, because this is relevant to what we're seeing right here. I believe I mentioned it last week. The interaction that we're seeing right here is something that happens directly after they escape the Harkonnen Ornithopter. Duncan finds them, picks them up, takes them to the safe space. We're talking
about that. And then says, hey, if I'm not back by whenever, get the fuck out.
Right. Right. Yeah. The moment that we see here in the movie is written down. It is something that we definitely like get in the books. When they escape the Harkonnen ship, Jessica sees the Ornithopter coming up to them, and she's like freaking out. She thinks there's more Harkonnen goons coming to get them.
They're just gooning around, dude.
They're now...
They're gooning all over the planet.
They're now gooning in flight, too. Which,
it's which impressive. Mid-air gooning?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that is frowned upon by most major airlines.
Well, you are studying to become a pilot.
That's true. I did not see...
Was there anything in the FAA guidelines about gooning mid-air?
I didn't see a specific regulation. Doesn't mean there isn't one out there. We'll get into aerodynamics of goonship later.
If you work at the FAA, y'all need to crack down on these gooners mid-flight, man. You can email us, goonminute@gmail.com. If you work at the FAA, we got some feedback for you.
Some questions. So yeah, she thinks it's more Harkonnen goons, but Paul, because he's in his Mentat mode, he knows it's Duncan by, and this is where the book quote starts, the accumulation of minutiae in the way it was flown, the dash of landing, clues so small that Paul's mother hadn't even detected them. So she's freaking out. She thinks it's Harkonnen's. And Paul's just like,
chill,
nah,
bitch.
Nah, you dumb bitch. It's clearly Duncan.
You can't tell by the micrometer movements that are happening that it's Duncan at the fucking flight stick. Yeah. You dumb bitch.
You dense motherfucker. Yeah, so it's...
He's like, this is why I like Thufir a lot better than any of you guys. Fuck you.
Yeah. And as a reminder, a lot of this chapter is, or a healthy portion of this chapter, is Paul getting frustrated by how slow his mom is thinking. So that's just...
She just can't keep up with me, man.
Yeah. He's having his big brain moment right now. So
knowledge.
Yes, Paul is correct. He can sense the, and he can tell who's flying it. By just the way that the ship is moving. And that's why he says before they've even seen the person.
That's Duncan.
That's Duncan. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's much less of an annoying exposition in the book than it is in the movie.
Yeah. No, I just think it's funny because like we have the Lisan Al Gaib, yet he's fucking Captain Obvious over here.
Yeah.
Just
he would remind the teacher that homework was supposed to be taken
off. Fuck you, Paul.
Yeah, he's that kind of guy.
Yeah. Piece of shit.
But yeah, that's all I had. So just a very short book comparison. Again, that comes from the beginning of the chapter. What we will talk about in this next minute is what we kind of get back on track with the book for what happens after they emerge from the tent.
Well, we'll have to do that tomorrow.
We'll do it tomorrow. That's a good time for it.
Alrighty. Well, in the meantime, if you'd like to reach out to us, like I said, if you work at the FAA and you know we need to talk to you about all these gooners in the sky, you can email us, DuneMinute@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter @DuneMinute or on Instagram @TheDuneMinute. We will be back tomorrow with a Friday episode to close this week out.
All right. We'll see you
later.
See you tomorrow.